From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. From short stories to films to novels, Mel Donaldson likes to tell stories. He explores the father-son relationship in his short film, A Room Without Doors. His latest novel, set in star-struck Southern California, draws its central characters from the fringes of society. A prostitute, a young gay man, a high schooler struggling to balance her ambition with her reality as a waitress. In film, essay, poetry, and prose, Donaldson writes about struggle, tragedy, endurance, family, and faith. And today on the program, he joins us to talk about the creative process. Plus, a celebration of the strange, tacky, and one-of-a-kind only on VHS, the Found Footage Festival comes to Salt Lake City. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning and welcome to City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Novels, poetry, film, it's all storytelling. But how do you take a narrative from one form and translate it to another? Our guide this hour is named Mel Donaldson, and he's done it all. He's a professor in the English department at California State University, Los Angeles. He's written and edited several textbooks, including the Encyclopedia of 20th Century African American Literature and Hip Hop in American Cinema. He's also a poet, a short story writer, and an essayist whose work has appeared in the Los Angeles Times, Upscale Magazine, Chicken Soup for the African American Soul, and other publications. And he's written two novels and written and directed two short narrative films. He is delivering the lecture From Close-Up to Performance, Adaptation from Short Story to Film, this afternoon at noon in the Linco Lounge at the University of Utah. We'll give you more details on that as we go. But Mel Donaldson is joining us by phone from Salt Lake City. And Mel, good morning. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you very much. I do appreciate it, and good morning to you.
Later on in the program, we'll turn to the strange and the hilarious. The Found Footage Festival is coming to Salt Lake City. But first, storytelling. If you're a writer or a poet or a filmmaker, how do you get the creative juices flowing on your project? Why did you choose to work in a particular medium? You can join our conversation. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Mel Donaldson, you grew up in New England, studied literature and American civilization in the Northeast at Brown University, and then you moved to Southern California. Why the change of venue?
Well, you know, it was one of those opportunities that I had. The opportunity being actually, while working on my PhD, I applied to the American Film Institute and as a screenwriter, and I was accepted. And so I first went out to California with this sort of energetic idea of both attending the American Film Institute, learning about filmmaking while working on my PhD, a bit overambitious. And discovered that that just wasn't possible. So I decided to go back, return to New England, finish up all the work I had to do on campus, and then return to California as I worked on my dissertation, and that got me back to California. And since 1980-81, since receiving my PhD, I've been sort of balancing the academic world along with the creative world.
Well, let's talk about that balance. You are an academic. You've written a lot of analysis about cinema and African-American literature and actors and you know, various themes. And yet you persist to write fiction and poetry and to produce movies. What is it? Why? Why that continual draw to the imaginary?
Well, that's a good question. I really don't have an answer for in terms of that kind of passion that one discovers, and I think a bit of talent that I do have in that area. But I do know that I've tried to have both feeding off the other. Though they're two different pathways. For example, as a film critic, when looking at films, whether it's a single film or body of work. You know, I'm looking at certain elements on the screen of the final product, assessing how the filmmaker maybe achieved, made a kind of a notable display of whether it's a visual or written aspect of the film, the aesthetics of film. on the other end, if I'm creating, I have to take off the critic's hat. You really cannot be a successful creative person, I believe, whether it's a writer or a filmmaker or a dancer or whatever, by necessarily being motivated from a critical point of view. In other words, I don't wake up and say, well, I'm going to write this short story in order for it to be a postmodern feminist perspective on the yama, yama, yama. I write a story because I'm exploring a character. I'm exploring the experiences that a character goes through, and the process is a different kind of creative process than the process of being a critic.
Do you find one more enjoyable than the other?
Well, you know, for me, there is, yes. The creative side is much more enjoyable, and the reason for that is that the creative process begins and ends with me. And it is a very, very long process, from inception to the actual work to the many, many stages of revision. The academic world is one in which a scholar enters an already established kind of world, and therefore, if I am writing a certain kind of critical examination of literature or film, I'm doing so with the understanding or with the acknowledging of the fact that other scholars have also done so. You know, the whole research process and bringing in perspectives from other scholars who have also explored that area. So in some ways, it's a different kind of approach that, you know, requires a certain kind of awareness of what others have done. But when I'm writing creatively, I'm focusing upon what I want to do with that particular work. So it's more of an enjoyment for me in that kind of individual pursuit, yes.
We're speaking with Dr. Mel Donaldson. He's a professor in the English department at California State University, Los Angeles. He's delivering a lecture this afternoon from close-up to performance, adaptation from short story to film. That's happening in the Linco Lounge. That's room 2110 at the University of Utah. And he's also going to be reading from his latest novel, Communion, tomorrow, Tuesday, November 27th at noon in OSH 106, again at the University of Utah. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. We're talking about the creative process and how you get started on fiction and film and poetry and prose. 801-355-TALK is the number. Dr. Donaldson, what gets you started? I mean, is it a character? Is it a plot line? Is it a theme that you want to explore? What gets your creative juices going?
For me, it always begins with character. You know, when I teach creative writing, I suggest to my students, because I don't want to necessarily dictate to them how they develop their creative process, but I certainly I highly suggest that they begin with character. And the reason for me is very simple. No matter how beautiful the language might be, no matter how many special effects you'll have in a film, what really stays with a reader or a listener or a viewer is some kind of engagement that they've had with a character in that film. Now, most times it's the protagonist, but it's not always. You know, sometimes, for various reasons, it could be a supportive character. It could be the antagonist, the villain. But it's having that experience that you connect to, either visualized or written within the piece, that really makes that piece come alive for you. And so for me, it always begins with character. And from there, particularly with the writing process of fiction or poetry, allowing that character to take you, the author, where that character wants to go in terms of those early drafts. When you go back to revise, now you're doing something a little bit differently. You're looking at something that has a beginning, middle, and end, and that's when you begin to perhaps think about those kinds of abstract things like themes, maybe symbolism. How do you now take something that you've written and make it perhaps even more memorable by tweaking or reshaping certain aspects of the story? But I think it really begins with character.
How do you decide which form to write in? Writing a short story as opposed to a screenplay, or as opposed to the novel? I mean, once you've got this character in your head, How do you know which form would fit it best?
Well, you know, that can be very challenging. I've met writers over the years who just feel comfortable within the genre of poetry. There's something about verse, whether it's a traditional verse with a kind of a metered line that has a certain amount of syllables that give you certain kinds of rhythms for each line, whether it's using in rhyme, whether it's using figurative language. Some people just feel comfortable within poetry. And some feel comfortable within fiction. I'm very fortunate, or perhaps cursed, in that I write in all genres, from stage plays to poetry and to fiction. And I don't say that in a kind of a bragging way. It's just for me, all of the various forms of expression all have a place where they intersect, but yet at the same time, they have some very distinctive qualities to them. So the novel that I'll be reading from tomorrow, Communion, it is it's a fictional narrative in third person, but there are places where my protagonist, because he's a poet, when I am writing about some of his experiences, I'm able to allow the narration to, you know, incorporate some of that poetic aspect of how he approaches language. So for me, there's an intersection, or can be an intersection, but what helps as you're beginning as a writer is to understand the various elements of each particular form. And you'll find that in those elements, such as character, plot, narration, there are and can be similarities, but also you begin to note, well, where are the differences? A screenplay is about a visual story. And so, therefore, as you're writing a screenplay, you have other kinds of objectives as opposed to writing a short story or a novel. So it's about learning the genre, about learning that form and what makes it work well by reading others who have written in that form, but at the same time being open to allowing those forms to intersect when they can.
Your seminar today, From Close-Up to Performance, Adaptation from Short Story to Film. I mean, when you're writing a short story and you think maybe this would work well on a screen, I mean, are you writing a story with a film in mind? Or, you know, are you trying to cross those bridges at the time of conception, if that makes any sense?
No, it does make sense. And I've been in a situation where I've been a writer for hire by a particular production company, knowing that the story, the novelization that I'm writing is something that's going to be the basis of a screenplay, which is going to be the basis of a film. And so I have had those kinds of assignments. However, ideally, if you are a fiction writer or poet, or you're writing a stage play or you're writing an essay, you want to be true to that particular form. You want to make certain that you are accomplishing within that particular genre in which you're writing, you know, those goals that you've set for yourself for that particular piece, that particular work. I think you can sabotage and you can undercut and undermine a given work if you're thinking too much about, oh, I'm writing this particular novel, and therefore I should write it this way because it's going to look this way on the screen. Because you really have to write the piece first, and then if you want to move towards a screenplay, which is what I'm doing now, my novel, Communion, then you have to think differently, because all the details that you may have in a novel or a short story, you cannot transfer those to the screen, to the visual story. It just doesn't work. My novel, Communion, for example, is about 430 pages. How do you put 430 pages into a two-hour film? You can't do it. You have to make decisions in regards to a screenplay that are different than the kind of decisions you make when you're writing a novel. And it just sort of means putting on a different hat and going through a different kind of process and understanding the medium that you're writing in, the genre.
I want to play a clip from your short film, A Room Without Doors. This is a scene. Set us up with the plot of this short film. A young a single parent in the late 50s and 60s looking for a way out, a way to build a better life for he and his young son. I want to play the clip, but do you want to say anything about this film? Was this a project that evolved from a short story of yours?
Actually, it did. It evolved from a sort of a novella that became a screenplay, and that screenplay for a full-length film was optioned by a small production company. That production company sort of listened to my pleadings that I was interested in directing the film. As a first-time director, the idea was that, well, you know, if you're going to try to, you know, sell this to someone and get some another company to help us to do a screenplay, let's do a short film to show that you can direct some aspect of this story. And that's how the short film emerged. So we went from a novella to a screenplay to a short film. And that was sort of the journey of that particular project. And as you said, it is set beginning in the 1950s, a young single dad. He's lost his wife. He's raising a son by himself, but he feels that there might be better opportunities for him and his son by going to New England.
This is a short clip from the short film, A Room Without Doors.
Clem.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to take you up on your offer. Borrow that money.
Yeah, I figured. So you decided to leave.
I got to get out of this place.
Well, from what I hear up north, ain't no paradise, D. I mean, look. You stay here. You got friends. You got people who care about you and Morgan.
I know. I know. I'm drowning here. I'm drowning. I feel like something is holding my head underwater. I can't get air to breathe. I'm not looking for paradise, Clem. I'm just looking for a place so me and my son can get a fair chance at life.
Again, a clip from the film A Room Without Doors by Dr. Mel Donaldson. He's also a professor in the English department at Cal State University, Los Angeles. Written several books, including his latest novel, Communion, which he'll be talking about at the University of Utah tomorrow. He'll also be presenting the lecture today, From Close-Up to Performance, Adaptation from Short Story to Film. Again, that's happening at noon in the Linco Lounge, room 2110 at the University of Utah. You can find out many more details on our website, kcpw.org. But we're talking about storytelling across various media with the writer and filmmaker and academic Mel Donaldson. If you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Today on the program, we're talking about writing, about filmmaking, and of course, storytelling. That's the heart of all of these media with Mel Donaldson. He is a professor in the English department at Cal State University, Los Angeles. He's written numerous textbooks and short stories and poems, and his latest novel is titled Communion. He will be delivering a lecture today, From Close-Up to Performance, Adaptation from Short Story to Film. That's happening at noon on the University of Utah campus. He'll also be reading from his latest novel, Communion, tomorrow, Tuesday, November 27th, at noon in OSH 106, again on the University of Utah campus. And if you'd like to join our conversation, what creative project are you working on? How did you find a voice for your protagonist or make the choices in a short story or a novel that you're working on? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Dr. Donaldson, your novel Communion centers on this quite diverse collection of people. You've got teenagers, you've got people in their 40s, but at the hub of this collection of characters is someone named Tony. He's a survivor. He's a caregiver. Tell us a little bit about this character and about the plot of the story.
Yes. One of the things that has sort of been a part of this sort of panoply of people that I've met over the years was a young man I met back in the mid-1980s. And I was, at that time, teaching high school on the west side of Los Angeles. And for about 2 to 3 months, this young man was sort of coming through the process. And what I meant was that he'd spent some time in juvenile hall, and he just turned 18, and they were putting him back into sort of a mainstream educational cycle. And he wound up in one of my classes because he had an interest in writing. And as we began to talk, began to learn more and more about this young man, and so his story was a very strong impetus to this novel. And and basically, the protagonist in the novel is a young man who finds himself living in Riverside, which is about an hour east of Los Angeles, and having some difficulty with a stepdad who doesn't accept the fact that his stepson is, as the stepdad would say, perhaps just a little bit too soft, a little bit too weak from a manly point of view. And it's because this young man is indeed a gay. And in addition to being gay, he is also a young man who enjoys dressing up in women's clothing and makeup. And he has had a life before the stepdad enters his life with his sister, where he's allowed to basically be himself. And so what happens is that with this stepdad in the picture, he all of a sudden is forced to deal with how others perceive him, and he runs away from home after an incident that happens. And living on the streets, he meets other street kids and eventually makes his way to Hollywood, and this is in the 1980s, and finds himself creating a family. And it is this family that he creates of people of different age groups, from the teens to the 20s to the 40s, different ethnic groups, Armenian, African-American, Vietnamese, Jewish. So he creates his own family of people who accept him for who he is, and in return, he tries to help his friends as best he can. And it is about survival, and it is about accepting oneself.
It's also about gender and about sexuality.
Yes.
Were those themes that you anticipated exploring when you created this character of Tony?
Yes. One of the things that I did in my graduate study was that, in addition to film, African American studies, I also began exploring the area of women in American society. And that was one of my particular areas that I integrated into my dissertation, and one of the areas that I teach. So that sometimes I will teach, for example, gender and sexuality in literature, or gender and sexuality in popular culture. So it's been a part of the academic world, my research, my writing. And so this particular novel gave me that opportunity to, again, use the academic side and to merge it with the creative side. So I wanted to have the opportunity to explore some issues that I felt are important in regards to what I call tolerance, and just allowing people to be who they are without judging them. And it sounds like a very small thing. I think it's a very small thing, but it's a very huge thing in our society. We spend so much time judging other people because we want everyone to be as we are. The bottom line is that will never happen. And so what has to occur in order for society to work well is that you begin to accept difference and realize that difference doesn't mean that one group is better than another, or one individual is better than another. It just means that a person is different. And they should be allowed to have that difference, just as you have your difference from that other person. So there are many things that touch upon gender, sexuality, age, generational differences that I try to explore in this novel, and I hope I was successful.
Another central theme, though, seems to be violence in our society. I guess this is part of the social commentary that you're taking on, but even the first chapter takes a very violent turn, and there are other violent scenes as the novel goes on. I mean, why would you choose to include the violence that you did in this novel?
Yes. It's a part of the American landscape, and I know we've heard others say this, and I don't mean it in terms of it being gratuitous. In the 1980s, one of the things that was happening in the Hollywood area, and to a great extent it still is happening, is that you had a lot of runaways, a lot of kids coming to Hollywood because they were looking for the Hollywood of their imaginations, that symbolic Hollywood that represented perhaps an avenue towards some kind of success. But there's the real Hollywood, and if anyone's had a chance to travel there, you'll see that it is a place that has its own kinds of realities, its own kinds of challenges. And to be a young person coming to a city and not knowing anyone, trying to figure out a way to survive, oftentimes you also can become a victim. And so the violence in the piece is on a number of different levels. There's emotional violence that Tony basically experiences with his stepdad. There's a kind of a psychological violence where society at large and certain factions of society attempt to basically demonize someone for who they are because they don't fit into the norm. And then there's physical violence. This kind of violence that perhaps hits our headlines most often, particularly in terms of people who are abused and unfortunately people whose lives are taken because of the rules of the streets. And so, yes, I wanted to also comment upon those different levels of violence and in particular how they do affect young people and how there is so much potential, I believe, in those young people reaching adolescence, but oftentimes that potential is not achieved because of a number of things that happen emotionally, psychologically, and then of course physically. So this is not a YA novel. It is not a young adult novel, even though some of the characters are in their teens. This is certainly a novel that explores some of the darker sides of who we are as human beings.
Mm. The title, Communion, the sections in the book are titled The Temple, the Book of Tony, The Altar Call. Clearly some religious overtones here. What role did you see religion playing in this plot?
Yes, I think that, and here I'm speaking from my particular experience and my particular belief system. I am what I would call a progressive Christian, which doesn't mean that that's better than any other religion. Just means that's the one that has the most, it resonates the most for me. So I'm really looking at my particular religious tradition. And if you go back and look at how Christianity has been used as a way of justifying so many things that we now know have been rather negative and pejorative, whether we're talking about slavery, whether we're talking about imperialism, whether we're talking about exploiting on so many levels. And so in a way, it's a critiquing of the what I call the misinterpretation of religion and the exploitation of religion. But at the same time, it became a unifying kind of concept, so that one way of bringing together all these disparate characters and locales within the novel was to sort of use this religious paradigm of the communion, the gathering, the worshiping of those who share a similar kind of perspective, which becomes Tony and this sort of family that he creates. And at the same time, looking at how each one of those members of the family, you know, they have their own experiences, their own testimonies that are given in the novel. The altar call has to do with a kind of coming forth and confessing that happens in traditionally in particularly in Protestant churches. The offering is a part of the ceremony of having conducting a service, and in this case, it's also not only an offering in terms of the giving to others, but also, unfortunately, that particular segment has to do with someone losing their life, and then the benediction, the ending of the novel. So, by taking those aspects of a kind of a traditional Christian Protestant service, it allowed me to sort of have an organizing structure for the novel.
Much of your writing deals with the African American experience, the identity that we see portrayed in the media. Your short film performance centers on a retired African American actor who made a name for himself as this character, very stereotypical of the early days of cinema, Nappy Coonfoot. I'm just wondering, in this so-called post-racial world that we live in, do you see the stereotypes persisting, or do you see, as in your short film performance, sort of a backlash on those stereotypes?
Well, you know, your question is a very good one, and you've touched upon a number of things, and I guess we can begin with post-racial, which I feel is a term that certain areas of the media have claimed, but no one within my real experience uses that term, because from the president down to the local grocer in your neighborhood, you're going to find that ethnicity is a part of what makes America what it is. Please, you can cut me off here if I get too lengthy, but let me just say this. Everyone in this country belongs to an ethnic group. Everyone belongs to an ethnic group. Now, whether you claim it or not is something different. So we have this racial group that is perhaps called Caucasian, but you can break that down into ethnic and cultural groups, whether it's Irish or Italian or Armenian. So because historically Caucasians have had the dominant position in society, any one of those ethnic groups that are part of that white racial group have been seen as the norm, okay? So therefore, we don't necessarily identify a particular candidate as the white candidate or the Irish candidate running for president. But because of the history in this country of race, when we look at what's called the underrepresented minority groups, and that's where we get into the various ethnic groups under the banner of being black or being Asian or being Latino, we tend to lead with an ethnic identity, so a person is Chicano, a person is African-American, before they are American. And that's sort of the history in a very, very quick way about race and ethnicity, okay? So everyone deals with race. It just may be that you may belong to that dominant group where you're not required or forced to deal with it on a daily basis, okay? That's what America is, always has been. When looking at the underrepresented minorities, what I try to do in this novel and what I try to do in my short story Close Up was to look at how popular culture has contributed to our general perceptions about those underrepresented groups. So Sam Montgomery is a character in the short story Close Up and also in the short film Performance who represents that 1930s, 1940s image of the black male. And for those who are old enough to remember, we're talking about people like Stephen Fetchett, Manton Moreland, even Eddie Rochester Anderson. These were images of black men who basically were very childlike, a bit bumbling, very much the clown, not too intelligent, not too articulate. And so those kinds of images were presented consistently in films and in television shows, so that in that consistency, some people perceived it as the truth. And so the short story in the film performance sort of explores what happens when a younger person, a younger journalist who is African-American, is confronting that older performer who's African-American in regards to those images portrayed in films and pop culture.
Dr. Donaldson, unfortunately, we've just got about a minute left.
I do tend to talk a lot. Yes.
No. We've just it feels like we've just scratched the surface on so many of the themes that you talk about in your work. I just want to ask, you admit in your online bio that the creative path for you has not been easy. You write that many projects sank as awkwardly as the Titanic, that you've shelved projects, that you've gone into debt for others. What is it about the creative part of your career that keeps you going at it?
It's that part of what I do that helps me to tap into you know, who I am on the inside, and the creativity is a form of expression, and to a great extent, a form of freedom, because I'm doing that thing which would, you know, gives me a certain kind of satisfaction in a way that nothing else does. Even a great bottle of wine doesn't give me the same satisfaction as creating a short story that you know, hits all those beats and notes that I'm trying to. So for me, the creativity is a form of expression, but it's also a form of freedom and connecting with myself.
Dr. Mel Donaldson, he's a professor in the English department at CS University, Los Angeles, the author of numerous books, a filmmaker. His latest novel is titled Communion. He will be delivering the lecture From Close-Up to Performance, Adaptation from Short Story to Film. That's happening today at noon in the Language and Communications Building in the Lounge, Linco Building, room 2110 on the University of Utah campus. He'll also be reading from his latest novel, Communion, tomorrow, Tuesday, November 27th at noon in Orson Spencer Hall, 106 on the University of Utah campus. And Professor Donaldson, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for the time.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Coming up next, we turn to found footage, the best and worst of VHS. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. The Found Footage Festival finally making its way to Salt Lake City, bringing discarded, odd, and hilarious video clips from garage sales, thrift stores, and dumpsters to the big screen. Today on the program, we're learning more about the joy of watching obscure video clips, from exercise tapes to training videos to home movies. Joining me for this segment is Nick Prewer. He's co-founder and curator of the Found Footage Festival. He's a former researcher at The Late Show with David Letterman. And along with his partner, Joe Pickett, they've written for The Onion and Entertainment Weekly. And Nick Prewer joins us by Skype from his home in New York City. Nick, great to have you. Thank you so much for the time.
Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks for having me.
The Found Footage Festival is bringing their 2012 lineup to Salt Lake City this Thursday, November 29th at 7:30 p.m. at Broovie's Cinema Pub. We'll give you some more details on that as we go. But if you've got a favorite VHS video clip of your own, you can join our conversation. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Nick Prewer, I understand you got started collecting found footage when you were working at a McDonald's and you found a stray training video. Tell us what was on this video.
It was remarkable. It set the whole thing in motion. I was bored in the break room one day and I was looking through their, you know, they had about 30 training videos and there was one that was just collecting dust there. Clearly no one had watched it in a long time. And it was called Inside and Outside Custodial Duties. And I was curious.
That sounds riveting.
Yeah. Well, to me, it did. I don't know. I was curious about it. So I put it in. And it was a training video for McDonald's janitors. And, we didn't have a janitor. So I guess that's why it never got watched. But it was so remarkable. It was just so insultingly dumb. I mean, it tried to have this cute plot to it. where it was this, you know, trainee's first day on the job, and this overly perky crew trainer was going to teach him how to find McDonald's clean. They called it McC. And it was just, my thought was that this can't stay in the break room. The world needs to see this video. So I pilfered it. I snuck it home in my backpack that night and showed it to Joe, who's the other Found Footage Festival co-host. And we fell in love with this video and developed a whole cult around it.
You showed a clip of this on Jimmy Kimmel Live. I think it was this last summer. And it's hilarious. This, you know, kind of perky employee cheering on this fellow employee saying, oh, you've done great, you know, on the windows. And
yeah, I can't wait to clean the bathroom.
You can't yeah. buy that kind of stuff. So tell us, what is it about VHS as a medium that just calls to you? What is it about the videotape that's, you know, rapidly disappearing?
Well, firstly, that's the format we grew up with. And so I think there's just some basic nostalgia we have for the, you know, in all its sort of clunky analog, you know, washed out glory. We really like VHS. And, you know, whereas, you know, you're doing something via Skype or the internet, you run into problems occasionally. You know what's going to play on a piece of analog media. You know, you put it in and it plays. But beyond that, VHS was just, it was such a revolutionary thing. People forget about that this was the first time you could really affordably have video in your home that you could control. And, you know, after the Jane Fonda workout, it was just a gold rush for people trying to cash in on this new craze. And, so you had tons of different exercise videos, and then training videos became easy to produce, and home movies, and really stupid ideas like, you know, the video fireplace and VCR board games and video aquariums. And we found a video called Rent a Friend, which is, you know, a virtual friend that you can pause.
That's so sad.
And play. Yeah, it is. It is really sad. But so I think it was just a unique time where it was sort of the Wild West. People were trying out new ideas and seeing what would stick. And it, you know, it was a format that had reached market saturation, and people didn't have a handle on what it was yet. So you got a lot of really unique and interesting things on VHS.
I need to share a couple of clips that I found on your website. So this is a training manual, I believe. It has to do something with shipping charges from a heavy metal guitarist. Let me play this clip and then just get you to respond. Again, this is from foundfootagefest.com, and we're speaking with Nick Pruer, who is a co-founder and curator of the Found Footage Festival, which is coming to Salt Lake City.
When you place an order, you're going to find that our service is very fast. Even though it took a few weeks for you to receive this, that's because one of two reasons. It took us a long time to get this developed in the first place, so we had to hold up orders. Another reason we have to send it the cheapest type of postage possible in order to send this to you free, and the cheapest is the longest. It goes to you on Camelback or something.
I have to say, this clip just cracked me up, mostly because this guy, you have to picture him, he looks like just this huge, big, blonde, heavy metal hair kind of guy. But he's talking about the most mundane thing possible, shipping charges. And I guess these are among the gems that you find in your work, Nick.
Yes, they are. And the guy, he sort of looks like an Owen Wilson character.
Yes,
you know, he's trying to, he's like a, you know, a heavy metal Owen Wilson, basically. And he's there with a guitar he's talking about the most mundane thing. And I just can't imagine somebody who's really into metal trying to learn some licks from this video and finding out why UPS is the proper way to ship more videos if you order them. So, you find the boring and mundane, but you also find, you know, just the incredible, crazy videos. It runs the gamut.
There are certain genres that you like to explore, like the training videos that we talked about, the how-to videos, but also some of the homemade videos, the people who are documenting things that you don't know why they've decided to put this in film form. And I'm thinking of the martial arts exercise that we see with the actor Danny Bonaducci.
Yes. Yeah, this is a I guess it was just Danny Bonaducci came and was demonstrating some martial arts as part of a martial arts demonstration that looks like it was in a high school gymnasium.
Yes.
That somebody shot on a tripod that was kind of sticking and it was handheld for a lot of it. And we just found this home movie and we're watching this karate demonstration. And we're like, whoa, there's Danny Bonaducci on there. And he's taking it so seriously. And, you never know what you're going to find. We bought an old VHS camcorder at a thrift store for like $5. And when we got home and plugged it in, out popped this half-recorded tape, this home movie from this karate demonstration. And there was Danny Bonaducci.
You never know what you're going to find. I guess that leads to my next question. Where are you finding all of these VHS tapes? Are you going to thrift stores all the time? Are you asking your friends and relatives? Are people sending them in to you now that you've got this tremendous fan base on the internet?
Yeah, luckily, part of the benefit of touring and having an internet presence now is that people know about the show and they will, if they've found something, they'll either bring it to the show or send it to us. And I just got a box of Huggies in the mail this morning that I had to sign for, but it wasn't Huggies. It was some a package from Portland, Oregon, full of VHS tapes. That's like Christmas morning.
You hit the jackpot.
Yeah, exactly. Love it. And then there's always a note about where they found them. And I mean, that's our favorite thing in the world. But Joe and I still really get a lot of enjoyment out of getting our hands dirty and going to Salvation Armies and Goodwills and garage sales, things like that. And just seeing what we can turn up, looking in bargain bins at video stores. And we're hitting the ground. And actually, we're really looking forward to our first time in Salt Lake, going and hitting the local thrift stores to find some local footage for the next time we're in town.
We'll describe the live show, the Found Footage Festival that you're bringing to Salt Lake. What could people expect for this evening of entertainment?
Well, it's a guided tour through our video collection. And the show we're bringing is brand new stuff that we found just within the last year. And the cool thing is, I mean, number one, it's stuff you can't see anywhere else. It's not on the internet. And that's rare in this day and age to have things that aren't immediately accessible on your smartphone. So that's unique. But also, I think people have gotten so used to just watching things on their phones or their laptops. And they forget what it's like to watch something in a theater with, 300 people who are there to laugh. And especially when it's stuff that wasn't meant to be shown in public. Mm. Then something magical, something transformative happens when you're watching this, children's potty training video on a big screen. And of course, Broovies serves beer too, which never hurts.
Never hurts. How many videos have you guys collected?
Last count was over 5,000. But that was before we began this big 50-state tour we're on. So every time we come back from a leg of the tour, we have another box of, a couple hundred videos. So I'm guessing we'll have, more than 6,000 by the time we're done with this tour.
So we've got Blu-ray, we've got on-demand, VHS. I mean, is something of a lost art these days? Does that make you feel nostalgic in any way, or is just the way the world goes?
Well, no, it terrifies me. The fact that this physical media is going away, because I there is something about having a tangible thing in your hand, as somebody who's a bit of a collector, VHS in particular. I mean, it's fun to have a shelf full of tapes that you can go through and sort through. It's the same reason I don't shop for groceries online. I mean, you kind of want to pick up the avocado, and I don't know. Maybe that's a bad analogy, but I really do think clearly physical media is going away, and I'm not. I mean, I like the convenience of being able to watch things on demand, but I don't know that it has the same charm. And I think in the same way that vinyl collectors come to enjoy all the hisses and pops and imperfections of that sound, because they like holding a record and they like, looking at the art while it's playing. And I think it's the same with us for VHS. It might not be as sexy as vinyl, but to us it is.
There is something voyeuristic about what you do, though. I mean, do you feel the least bit guilty watching those potty training videos or the outtakes of somebody trying to make a commercial and, you know, it's not going well, and so you see the frustration on their faces? Do you feel a little guilty about that?
Well, no. I mean, no, because we have no scruples at all. I think I would if the show was mean-spirited, but it's really not. I mean, I have embarrassing home videos that I've played at shows, and you know, I think everybody has something in their VHS closet. And you know, one thing we do as part of the show is try to track down the people, the producers of, or the people in these videos. And whenever we do, they love the fact that they've sort of become, you know, cult heroes of sorts. And they're willing to, like, sort of look back and laugh at this stuff, you know, in addition to the people in the audience. So I really think that if we were mean about it, or if it was too snarky, I could definitely see it coming across as, you know, or feeling guilt about it. But, you know, our sort of rule is, if the person was in the room, and a lot of times they are, would we be okay with showing this and treating it the way we do? And so that's sort of our test. I think the people we've met have really gotten a kick out of the fact that they're, you know, they're being celebrated 20 some years after the fact.
Mm. You've been featured on Jimmy Kimmel, as I mentioned, and in The Onion, and now you're on a national tour. Where does the found footage project go from here?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. You know, we're working on a TV show for the Science Channel, of all play, where we would, you know, interview some of the people from these videos, and it would follow us around at live shows and digging through thrift stores for videos, and you know, maybe explaining the science behind VHS in the process. So maybe a TV show. We just put out a book recently that has, you know, each VHS cover we find is a work of art. So we put out a coffee table book of 300 of our favorite covers from our collection, along with our commentary about it. But honestly, I mean, the most fun part for us is just being able to share our VHS collection with strangers. I mean, it's the funnest thing in the world to it's like doing a show and tell every night in a new city, and we're pretty proud of our collection. So as long as we're able to still do that and people still show up, we'll be happy.
Nick Brewer, he's co-founder and curator of the Found Footage Festival, coming to Salt Lake City this Thursday night, November 29th at 7:30 p.m. at Broovy Cinema Pub, 677 South, 200 West, here in Salt Lake City. For tickets and more information, you can go to our website, kcpw.org. Nick Brewer, thanks so much for the time, and look forward to having you in Salt Lake City.
Thanks, Jennifer. We're looking forward to it.
City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.